the headlines, a UN human rights expert says unilateral sanctions have inflicted enormous humanitarian crises across the world. Iran says sanctions amount to terrorism and war crimes, noting that U.S. measures have hindered the country's access to food and medicine. And official data shows U.K. goods exports to the European Union fell over 40% in January. That's the biggest drop since records began in 1997. Hello and welcome, everybody. A UN human rights expert says unilateral sanctions have inflicted enormous humanitarian crises across the world.
When we speak about the consequences of application of unilateral sanctions, it's necessary to say that today, unfortunately, the humanitarian impact has already become enormous. When we speak about the sectoral sanctions, they affect the whole population of the country. But the same, something very similar is happening when we come to sanctioning or designating specific individuals, because the number of these individuals became so enormous, and now it's so easy to list someone and to add someone to the list, that the whole countries and economies of the whole countries become cut off their normal trade relations or any sort of international relations with other states.
Duhan said unilateral sanctions exacerbate pre-existing issues in targeted countries, turning them into crises. She added that the coercive measures are affecting people's right to food, health, and life. The UN Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures and Human Rights stressed that the sanctions ultimately undermine the right to development of the whole nation. She called for serious dialogue in the international arena to settle disputes. UN and human rights experts have frequently criticized the United States over its use of economic sanctions for political purposes. They say such actions are clearly contrary to international law and may precipitate man-made humanitarian catastrophes of unprecedented proportions.
The United States' close ties with some of the regimes in West Asia, especially its support for oil-rich Persian Gulf Arab rulers, have long been blamed for many of the problems in this part of the world. A case in point is Saudi Arabia, which is controlled by an autocratic regime with a notorious human rights record. It never gets even a slap on the wrist for its violations of human rights inside the kingdom and its destabilizing actions in the region. Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war gets little attention on Western news channels and no criticism from the White House. Later this month, it will be the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led offensive against its southern neighbor. The U.S. is definitely a partner in this aggression. For most of the war, the U.S. military provided support, including intelligence and logistics for the Saudis and their Emirati allies. In response to the ongoing Saudi-led bombardment, the Yemenis have been learning to hit back with missile strikes and drone operations. And this is definitely angering the Saudis and their supporters, who have loudly condemned Yemeni retaliatory attacks. Such stances, especially by the United States, have drawn fierce criticism. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed the U.S. for distorting the truth about what is happening in the region.
On this news review, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says sanctions are inhumane and illegal measures which have consequences similar to those of terrorism and war crimes. Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the consequences of sanctions are as brutal and criminal as those of terror and war crimes. He made the comments at a UN Security Council meeting on hunger and famine and conflicts. Iran's envoy said sanctions are one of the main causes of creating food insecurity. Takht-Ravanchi also spoke about U.S. sanctions on Iran. He said the measures have hindered Iran's access to food, medicine, and medical equipment amid the pandemic. He also called for the immediate lifting of the ongoing siege on Yemen and the Gaza Strip. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have founder of transnational.live, Mr. Jan Oberg, who's joining us from Lund. Also, we have political analyst John Bosnich joining us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Oberg. Jan, do you agree with the comments made by Mr. Majid Takht-ar Avanchi that sanctions they are inhumane and illegal measures equivalent to those of terrorism and war crimes?
Oh, yes. If you define terrorism as trying to achieve a political goal by harming, hitting, or killing innocent civilians and not combatants, which is a characteristic of terrorism versus warfare, that it deliberately hits innocent people who are not party to the conflict, then this is an act of terror. If you can prove, which we've already heard, that this is very hurtful for millions of people. I myself have seen sanctions applied on Serbia, Macedonia, on Iraq, where they killed more people in the sanctions over 13 years than in the warfare. And I've seen it in Syria, where they uphold it still. I mean, Syria is probably the second or third largest humanitarian catastrophe since 1945, and a completely destroyed country in at least parts of the country, but complete destruction where it has been destroyed, such as eastern Aleppo. And I'm appalled by the fact, and I'm ashamed of the fact, that this is done to innocent people. I think it's right to say that. And I'm very glad, finally, to see that 16 countries have today announced that they formed a group of friends in support of the UN Charter, because this behavior has nothing to do with international law and it's against the letter and spirit of the UN Charter.
Mr. Bosnich, your thoughts on the issue. Do you agree with Mr. Oberg, who doubled up on the comments made by Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, sanctions specifically during the global pandemic that we're experiencing right now are equivalent to terrorism and war crimes and are a collective punishment?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm very happy to be on this program with Jan Oberg, whose work I've been following and reading with great agreement. I would like to say that the foundation of a peaceful world was meant to be formed through the United Nations, through the World Trade Organization, through free trade agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement. And these institutions are all jeopardized by unilateral sanctions. All of these institutions indicate that sanctions, unilateral sanctions especially, are a violation of the concept of multilateral peaceful interaction between states. So I would like to not use the word that sanctions are equivalent to terrorism. I would like to just say sanctions are terrorism. It's not an equivalency. It is a form of terrorism, and terrorism is a form of war. And so we have four steps if we want to achieve a war, if that's what our objective is. First, we have a false history. We present the story about, let's say, Iran as a false history. All of the historical facts about Iran are not made available to the people of North America. I'm here in New York. I can tell you there's nothing truthful being circulated in the media here about Iran, about Iran's history, about Iran's contributions to the world. Nothing, not a word. Second, you introduce contemporary propaganda and hate literature against the state, blaming them for everything you can possibly blame them for, to instill a new modern hatred against them, because it's always easier to kill somebody who you've previously demonized. Third, you introduce trade and economic sanctions. And since the rest of the world is against war generally, because the economies of most of the countries of the world are not based on the war machine or the military-industrial complex, you have to do it unilaterally if you're in the United States, because other people will not go along with it. The EU did not want to go along with sanctions against Iran or against Russia or against China, because they have to trade with them to keep their people at work. And finally, these the last aspect of this third element of war, sanctions, is to try and turn the people of a nation against their own government, to cause them to participate in a coup d'etat in which infiltrators sent by the United States lead a civil uprising or unrest against their state. And if that does not bring the state down, it destabilizes the target state enough so that a quick war against them can be successful. So these are the four steps to war: false history, propaganda, sanctions, and then outright war. And that's where we are now. We have a unilateralist system being propagated by the United States in direct contravention of all of the international norms of multilateral cooperation. And I can tell you, the chickens are going to come home to roost on this one, because the United States has an economy which, if it does produce something for sale, it has to be sold around the world. And they simply will not have any markets left if they close those markets by putting sanctions on target countries. So they will be hurting themselves, and their empire, which is dependent on trade, controlled by military distribution lines, will fall. So they will make it, they will be scoring the biggest own goal in modern history.
Mr. Holberg, in Lund, Iran's Mr. Avanchi also spoke about the U.S. sanctions, as we've been focusing on right now. He said the measures have hindered Iran's access to food, medicine, medical equipment amid the pandemic. Don't you think at this specific time right now, where the world is suffering globally, there should be some form of a collective pressure to get the United States to remove these sanctions or alleviate the pressure when the world is at a challenging time like the pandemic that we're in right now?
Well, definitely. I've argued for years that we need a civil disobedience campaign among NATO countries and everywhere else against the U.S. empire and its net, very destructive impact on the rest of the world. And actually, having never been an anti-American, which would be absurd, I must say, I think the Mr. Bosner's wonderful, elegant 4 points are totally to the point, I would say, as a peace researcher, conflict and war scholar, and this is hurtful to the U.S. and the Western world itself. And I don't understand why NATO allies in Europe, which are, if anybody will be listened to in Washington, it would be the allies, that they are lying flat, both in NATO and the European Union. Unless there's a counter pressure, and that's what we call dialectics, I think, well, anyhow, in the longer or shorter perspective, the U.S. empire will fall. It's obviously declining and about to fall. But I would like that to be a peaceful fall. And that means political pressure, diplomatic work, civil disobedience, no longer taking orders from Washington. The secondary sanctions in Europe is disgusting to me. They do hit also humanitarian assistance from European countries to Iran. And therefore, as I said in the beginning, I'm very happy to see that there are 16 countries led by Russia and China who today have declared that they will be the friends of the Charter. Because the world has to come back to international law and to the UN Charter, which is the most important and most Gandhian document governments have ever signed. We cannot survive in this world if we let a little group of countries, particularly the US, violate on a daily basis the norms and provisions and the letters of the UN Charter and international law. The fact that your country is hit by it is only one among many. It's bad, but it's many other countries that are hit by these violations, such as Syria has been too, in a more brutal way. And I'm appalled by the fact that Biden promised that he would come up with a new way of getting Iran engaged and the JCPOA on the table again. And then what he does is nothing but standing on the shoulders of Trump's policies, which was to withdraw from it. If Biden was an honest and decent person, he would long ago have said, without conditions, we are getting back to and entering again the JCPOA, and from there we might discuss certain things. But saying we're not going to do that before Iran does this or that, is appalling to me, given that he promised that he had some ideas that were better than Trump. He's even worse than Trump in this case.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. The founder of Transnational.live, Jan Oberg, joining us from Lund. Also, thanks to political analyst John Bosnich joining us from New York. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Iran says one of its container ships has come under terrorist attack in international waters in the Mediterranean Sea. The spokesman for the Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Line said Iran Shahrekord was sailing toward Europe when it was struck by an explosive device on Wednesday. Ali Biosian said the attack damaged a part of the ship's hull but caused no casualties. He said such attacks constitute a clear example of maritime piracy and are a violation of international law. Biosian stressed that Iran will take legal action through relevant international institutions to identify the perpetrators. China has urged the United States to stop interfering in Hong Kong's affairs.
We urge the U.S. to stop interfering in Hong Kong affairs, to stop interfering in China's internal affairs, and not to go down the wrong path even further.
The Chinese official said his country will resolutely safeguard its sovereign security and development interests. His comments came after the U.S. condemned China over planned reforms to Hong Kong's electoral system. Washington described the reforms as an effort to push back democracy in the city. China's Congress approved the reforms on Thursday to ensure only, quote, patriots run Hong Kong. A top Chinese government official has defended the decision, saying the changes are needed to quell unrest in the city.
It is necessary to close loopholes and eliminate deficiencies in the existing legal system of the Hong Kong, and also helpful to improve the system for implementing the principle of one country, two systems.
The Chinese official in charge of Hong Kong policy said the reforms coupled with a last year's security law represent a combination of punches to manage the chaos in the city. He said the problem in Hong Kong is a political one and outside forces are fomenting disruption there. Washington has backed anti-China protests that rocked Hong Kong in 2019. Official data shows Britain's exports to the European Union dropped by over 40% in January following the country's official departure from the bloc. The figure provided by the Office for National Statistics shows the biggest drop since the export data compilation began in 1997. The office said temporary factors are likely to be behind the fall. ONS data shows that the country's overall economy also shrank by 2.9% in the first month of the year. The COVID-19 pandemic took a heavy toll on Britain's economy last year when it contracted by 10%. That was the worst performance of the British economy in over the last three centuries. Our London-based correspondent Amina Taylor told us about the reasons behind falling exports between the UK and the EU.
We've seen 9% drop in terms of the overall contraction of the British economy since the beginning of the pandemic last year. So not only are we failing to sell more to Europe, and some of this was to be expected, after all, we do know that because of these new tariffs, because of the new trading arrangements that have come into force since the end of last year, officially the beginning of 2021, we would have seen some set of the markets. But in industries like manufacturing, chemical production, in car manufacturing, we're seeing a slow disentanglement of business from Brussels and elsewhere to the UK. And I think the government will be looking very soundly at what this means, especially, Badia, when you think we've only seen a 1.7% jump in trade with non-EU countries. And this should have been the thing that would have offset any of these losses.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Lindsey Graham has claimed that Donald Trump could destroy the GOP amid concerns about the party's 2024 election chances. Graham, a North Carolina senator and Trump ally, said in an interview that aired recently that he was trying to harness the so-called dark magic of former U.S. President since his departure from office in January. "What I'm trying to do is just harness the magic," Mr. Graham said of Mr. Trump, who he admitted could also destroy the GOP in 4 years' time with an alleged dark side or make the party more diverse. Dear listeners, please stay tuned for an article in this regard written by John Slotnick, writer. This article is published under the heading "Lindsey Graham admits Trump could destroy the Republican Party." Here's more. In a recent interview with Axios, Senator Lindsey Graham described former President Donald Trump's hold over the Republican Party as something of a hostage situation. The former president, Graham said, could make the Republican Party something that nobody else I know could make it. He could make it bigger. He could make it stronger. He could make it more diverse, and he could also destroy it, unquote. The senator continued to describe the former president along the lines of the duality of man. Trump, he said, has both a dark side and some magic in him. What I'm trying to do is just harness the magic. Prior to Trump's nomination in 2016, Senator Graham had been a staunch critic of the former president, arguing that he was not mentally fit for the role. After Trump was nominated, however, Graham quickly fell into Trump's good graces, becoming one of his most ardent allies. Although Graham did not support Trump's impeachment, the senator admitted that Trump needs to understand that his actions were the problem leading up the Capitol insurrection. Donald Trump was my friend before the riot, Graham said, and I'm trying to keep a relationship with him after the riot. I still consider him a friend. What happened was a dark day in American history, and we are going to move forward, unquote. He continued, so here's what you need to know about me. I'm going to continue. I want us to continue the policies that I think will make America strong. I believe that the best way for the Republican Party to do that is with Trump, not without Trump. The senator's comments come amid a great reckoning among conservatives about Trump's influence in the future of the Republican Party. Several Republicans, such as Representative Adam Kinzinger and Senator Mitt Romney, have expressed an interest in charting a new course without Trump. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has criticized Trump in the past several weeks, but said that he would ultimately support the former president's potential bid in 2024. Trump has been selective about his endorsements in the upcoming Senate elections. Weeks ago, Trump backed the primary opponent of Representative Anthony Gonzalez, who was one of the 10 senators who voted to impeach him. The former president also endorsed Senator John Kennedy, Jerry Moran, and Senator Tim Scott, the only black Republican in the Senate. Trump has also shown signs of breaking with certain Republican organizations, cashing in on his political capital. Recently, NBC News reported that the former president's lawyers sent cease and desist letters to three Republican organizations, the Republican National Committee, the National Republican Congressional Committee, and the National Senate Committee, demanding that they discontinue the usage of Trump's name and likeness. During Trump's CPAC speech 2 weeks ago, the former president listed off the names of congressional Republicans who voted to impeach him, urging his followers to get rid of them all. He said that the only way to support efforts is to elect Trump-supporting Republicans.
We get people.
U.S. Media Monopoly.
The role that the media and the press play in the United States is crucial for both people high up in power and for those on the streets. It's no surprise that spreading disinformation has real-world consequences. In some cases, dangerous ones. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Mardi, and in this episode, we will ask, how much of the truth does the mass media reflect as the human quest for truth continues? We will try to find out what potential dangers could be arising from the monopoly on mainstream media in the United States. And then, what about the viewers facing a barrage of fake news and partisan media channels? Is there any trust left? Thank you for staying with us.
It amazes me when I read the Wall Street Journal, which is always so negative. It amazes me when I read the New York Times is not even, I barely read it. You know, we don't distribute it in the White House anymore, and the same thing with the Washington Post. They are siding with China. They are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They're siding with many others. China's the least of it. It is fake news. It's more than fake news. It's corrupt news.
Media outlets work based on profit, and they have never been more consolidated than today. They tend to give their consumers what they want to hear and act in the interests of the umbrella corporations controlling them. On the other hand, U.S.-owned social media such as Twitter and Facebook are amplifying disinformation and cracking down on freedom of speech.
What they choose to fact check and what they choose to ignore or even promote is nothing more than a political activism group or political activism, and it's inappropriate.
But I think one of the most terrifying parts of it involves a suggestion that the government should be setting ground rules for what speech is or is not allowed on a platform.
Today, concentration of media ownership by only a few companies or individuals has a big say in the United States' political spectrum. Former President Donald Trump was banned from Twitter after he refused to accept the election result. Yet for years, Trump had been using the platform to issue threats to other nations and politicians. We're now joined by Mr. Tim Kirby. Mr. Kirby, please tell us about the disinformation being projected today and how it's changed through time, and what makes it unique and specifically dangerous.
This is nothing new, and disinformation has existed throughout all time, and even during the more golden age of the media that people sort of prop up, like the 50s and 60s and 70s, this height of journalistic integrity, even then it really existed as well. So I don't think that disinformation existing is particularly different now. The difference is that with the rise of the internet and the accessibility of the internet, the speed and the ability to be disinformed from various different sources has sort of changed the nature of the game. There's more competition, and the speed is much faster.
Trump's lack of access to Twitter has indeed shifted the dynamics of the so-called MAGA movement under President Biden. The particular platform that has blocked certain figures will lose their supporters not just on the platform, but also in the stocks. Twitter shares closed down more than 6% lower on the first trading day after the Trump ban.
We've seen abuse, we've seen harassment, we've seen people leave our platform because of it, we've seen voices being silenced because of what's happening on the service, and that is number one. Like, we can't build a platform of speech, a platform of conversation, and a service that will remain relevant to people if people don't feel safe to speak up in the first place. So for all those who believe in free expression and all those who believe in free speech, it's critical that we're not utilizing technologies like Twitter to shut down voices.
Liberal media's tough stance on the Capitol siege, Trumpists, also has long-term ramifications that will widen the gap in America. It also unashamedly panders to the Democrats. That is how the media is playing its part in the American divide.
It's no surprise to see distrust in media, as well as rising partisanship, extremism, and even domestic terrorism. But how did we get here? Let's see what Kristen Harris thinks. Mr. Harris, your take.
I think that the major issue with disinformation is it pushes people to go look in different areas for their news. For example, you have a larger amount of people than ever that are getting their news from forums, like what we saw with the QAnon thing, where they no longer trust the mainstream media narrative due to all the disinformation that to them is easily debunked because they can go search on the internet for alternative facts or different informations or downloads that may support their point of view.
Take what the conservatives call cancel culture and how it's raging today on social media. Many right-wing figures are being canceled on social media, and the conservative voice is being silenced at a time when the election is being disputed and recognition of the new president is under question.
So what happened with your Twitter account and the company page?
Well, first, mine was taken down because we have all the election fraud with these Dominion machines. We have 100% proof. And then I when they took it down about 3 weeks ago. I'm going to put it back up. My personal, I put it. It was a
Mike, thank you very much. You're talking about machines that we at Newsmax have not been able to verify any of those kinds of allegations. We just want to let people know that there's nothing substantive that we've seen. And let me read you something there. While there were some clear evidence of some cases of vote fraud and election irregularities, the election results in every state were certified.
As liberals retake power in the year 2021, the left-leaning media looks more aggressive than ever in the wake of the Trump era. The liberal agenda and how it is using mass media to promote it is a lengthy one. But forced equity, diversity, as well as political correctness are reshaping the American society in a fashion that could ultimately spin out of control. So what are the costs of a biased media today?
Adrenaline junkies and people of different right-wing groups were involved, and one of those was QAnon people. And the reason why people turn to things like QAnon, it's because the media has become so biased to one point of view to the point where a whole half of the United States doesn't deem them credible. And even the people on the left question what the mainstream media narrative is. So what it does is it forces people to get their news from forums where strange people post bizarre beliefs, and when you ban all the independent media, essentially under the guise of Russian collusion, there's no gatekeeper there.
The pace of media takeovers by large national and multinational corporations has been increasing since mid-20th century. Currently, six giant conglomerates control 90% of what media consumers read, watch, and listen to. General Electric, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, News Corp, and Disney control a majority of American-owned media.
Together, these six empires, federations, alliances own about 90% of all media in the United States. In 1983, or the old Republic era, there were 50 companies owning that same share of media. So why is this important? Should you be worried? Well, it's not exactly a black and white issue.
Enormous media conglomerates have expanded their influence, leading to a shortage of meaningful content and alternative viewpoints. Trust in the news media is being eroded, and some communities are growing in their own alternate reality, yielded by the one-sided media they consume. How do media treat those trying to disrupt its agenda?
I think the idea of this pro-Trump revolution was terrifying enough that they've now put the stakes down. Because even before this, they started to ban conservatives who are more, I wouldn't want to say extreme, more eccentric conservatives, more vibrant conservatives, like Alex Jones and a few others. But now they've just blanket attack any conservative who is conservative or right-wing enough to not accept their agenda.
Trump's supporters' attack on the Capitol is one contemporary example of how media falsehood could create cults. The former president's fans refused to accept the reality that Trump's allegations of election fraud had been left out of court.
They then began fantasizing about how their leader had a hidden trick up his sleeve not to allow Biden to enter office as the president.
Hundreds of thousands of people here, and I just want them to be recognized by the fake news media. Turn your cameras, please, and show what's really happening out here, because these people are not going to take it any longer. They're not going to take it any longer. All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
So in reality, they rushed at the request of the president to supposedly save their democracy and their votes. The other side of the coin is the thirst for truth by the youth, women, people of color, and immigrants, which is yet to be quenched. But what role did U.S. media play in the deadly breach of the Capitol by Trump supporters, and what are the aftermath?
That's an important thing, because remember, the media always has the option to just ignore something. If it didn't happen on TV, it didn't happen, is the old expression. I would say that maybe now if it didn't happen on YouTube, it didn't happen. We could update that for the 21st century. But they did choose to show it. But they definitely made it clear that these people are bad. They are all Nazis, even the black people who were part of it. and so on. They put a very clear sort of framing on it, and that somehow it is definitely Trump being at fault.
The narrative is controlled by virtue of the ownership of giant media corporations. Many media property owners tend to follow the approach adopted by elected officials who know the truth, but instead choose to propagate lies. Controlled by one czar, the American public would have a good reason to fear for its democracy and remain skeptic about what they read on social media outlets.
Multiple, well-documented significant harms. And we actually have to confront these harms head-on when trying to make decisions about whether or not we embrace this technology and let it into our lives. So one of these harms that we know this technology brings has to do with your professional success. So I just argued before that the ability to focus intensely, to produce things that are rare and valuable, to hone skills that the marketplace values, that this is what's going to matter in our economy. But right before that, I argued that social media tools are designed to be addictive.
Stereotype of an American surfing through TV channels somehow captures the struggle for finding out truth. But those high up want to stay in power, prepared to do whatever it takes to manipulate the discourse. How successful have czars controlling U.S. media been in manipulating the narrative?
Well, pretty effective. It's been effective enough to get the United States involved in a lot of wars. The United States has entered World War I, Vietnam, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars over very dubious claims. I mean, we never found those weapons of mass destruction, did we? So in a lot of ways, the narrative is created by the media. And in fact, there's really no other narrative outside of theirs. They control that, they create it, and for better or worse, we receive it. And unfortunately, it would look like as time goes on, it gets worse and worse.
There is no real access to truly diverse and competing sources of news, literature, entertainment, and popular culture. Concentrated power over public information has created a niche for the alternatives. Some are taking advantage of the gap in the market by promoting conspiracy theories. Trump was a master of employing conspiracy theories and using them to his advantage.
You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. Then Trump University gets sued for fraud and racketeering. He claims the court system and the federal judge is rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged.
What is the liberal agenda, and how is it using mass media to promote it? That's what Danny's going to talk about today. Hello, Danny. What do you have for us?
Thank you, Milad. This week, I am talking diversity and answering the questions, does diversity in the United States lead to justice? Does it lead to peace? And how does diversity maintain the status quo amid unprecedented crisis and societal decay? The answer is no. Diversity does not lead to justice, and it doesn't lead to peace. The corporate media has praised Joe Biden for his diverse cabinet, and the Los Angeles Times has given the front page to Kamala Harris, his vice president, who is a black woman, and has praised Joe Biden for nominating Lloyd Austin as a Secretary of Defense. Yet Lloyd Austin was a board member of Raytheon, one of the major weapons manufacturers in the world, which produces weapons of mass destruction deployed in black and brown nations around the world to destroy them. Kamala Harris is an agent of the police state, of the mass incarceration state, as a DA and as a prosecutor and as a senator. She has mocked activists for advocating for the defunding of prisons and the funding of public education. She has also been responsible for massive arrests of black Americans, mainly for minor drug possession. These are not the kind of leaders that diversity should be promoting. So why does the corporate media promote this kind of diversity? Because, in fact, a more diverse empire is a more effective empire. The United States is able to wage wars around the world, institute devastating economic inequality, and maintain a racist power structure, all the while claiming that it in fact has gotten closer to being less racist because of diversity. This is what leads to developments like Donald Trump and the extreme right. And we need to understand how diversity does not mean justice and peace if we are going to have a more progressive and more peaceful future in the United States and abroad.
In the late Obama era, Trump took the chance to put his ideas into test. He told America's story in a rather novel way compared to the US media, and many gravitated to him. After 4 years in office, the president fabricated tens of thousands of lies and baseless allegations, but his supporters still considered him the only honest man in the room. So what were the dynamics of the communication between Trump and his supporters?
Media is the reason why Donald Trump used Twitter, because he used it as a way to talk directly to the American people. Not that I agree with the things he said, but it was for the first time in history that we've seen a president be able to communicate directly with the people, and they did this through Twitter. Now, making threats on Twitter, do I think that's a presidential thing to do? Absolutely not. I think that maybe some of it was for show. Some of it was so that the message may not be perverted, but I think a phone call and a conversation would have been a much better option.
Media is at the center of the American power play. Having a real choice of politics and ideas has become a more scarce phenomenon, as many people repeat the talking points fed to them by media, and that is their political view. The media knows that and is somehow making a benefit by pumping that certain attitude towards life and politics.
It's important to believe in, you know, to have respect for everyone's religion.
So you respect Christianity?
I do.
Judaism?
Yes.
Islam?
No.
Can a woman be president?
The presidency is a man's job.
I have women are qualified to be president.
No. A female has more hormones. She could start a war in 10 seconds.
The people tend to follow news outlets they agree with. The outlets are making money through their supporters, so they're more adamant in highlighting what their viewers want. They could help one another get increasingly ignorant.
The media has the ability to turn the light switch on and off using their data. And for some people, it works very well as far as controlling information and allowing people to download certain viewpoints and conditioning them that certain things are acceptable. There's a large and growing amount of cognitive dissonance amongst Americans due to them watching media.
In a society where inaccuracy and biases abound, seeking truth remains a serious challenge. Media property owners must be held accountable, along with elected officials, for lying to the nation and opting for power over truth. Yet in reality, both the media and officials mostly choose to propagate lies, serving their own interests.
You've used words like garbage and lies and smear to describe the recent wave of stories about your past. Are you saying that organizations like Politico and CNN and the Wall Street Journal are deliberately trying to damage you?
Yes.
Why?
To put it simply, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Why?
Because, you know, when you deliberately lie and you put that out as a story, or you do shabby investigation and you say, we've investigated and we can't find anything. I mean, is that an acceptable standard? I mean, you're in the media. Is that acceptable?
Generally, journalists have to nail down a story before they publish it or broadcast it.
Right. So I don't have any problem with people looking at my past. I don't have any problem whatsoever with being vetted. But when people are outright dishonest, that's worrisome to me.
Our guest tonight is Ted Rall. He's an award-winning
editorial cartoonist and columnist, and author of the new book, Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Ted, thank you for joining us. Let's get to it. We want to know, basically, to what extent the American public has lost faith in what is sometimes referred to as the mainstream media.
There's a allegory relating to people's congressmen. Congress, for a long time in the United States, has had an approval rating hovering around 10, 11, 12%. And yet, incumbent congressmen keep getting reelected. So why? It's because people don't like Congress in general, but they like their own congressmen, or at least they're willing to tolerate them. Same thing, I think, is true about distrust of corporate media. In general, people have an understanding that systemically, they don't trust what comes out of corporate media, that it's a lot of it's propaganda, that the corporate ownership has a huge influence. But in terms of the outlets that they like or that they tolerate, or perhaps more accurately, that they dislike the least, for example, if you're a conservative, that might be Fox. If you're a liberal, that might be MSNBC. They have more of a love-hate relationship with those outlets. And even though they might say that they don't trust the whole system, the fact is they do listen to and watch to these and read these outlets, and it ends up being the source of much of what they believe. So if there was really widespread distrust of all corporate media outlets in the U.S., they wouldn't really have substantial influence, but they clearly do. They shape the narrative in a very real way, so that things that are not true become true and they become widely accepted. So, for example, Russiagate scandal, or that are, you know, didn't happen, but, you know, most Americans think it did, especially depending on which outlet you watch. So it's kind of like the Congress thing. People don't trust the whole thing overall, but whether they admit it to themselves, much less to pollsters, or not, there are outlets that they are listening to, watching, and reading, and they are trusting them, even though maybe they shouldn't.
Interesting stuff, as always. We want to thank you so much, Ted, for joining us tonight. We want to thank audiences at home for tuning in. For We the People, I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
Whether it's about the election, public health, or climate change, divide rages on in U.S. media today. This is while the elite in control of news and entertainment keep targeting the average person consuming immense amounts of information, news, and entertainment every day, a phenomenon that has made a large number of Americans addicted to the media. Thank you. Please join us again next week when we'll come back with another episode of We the People.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.